it's very important to get what's meant by mimetic desire right, because people sometimes assume it means that Girard thinks that there is something called desire and some versions of it are mimetic, whereas Girard's making a rather simpler claim than that. He says that desire, human desire, is mimetic. In other words, that we as humans pick up who we are from others. And this is, as it were, so there isn't such a thing as non-mimetic human desire. There are different ways of living mimetically because we're all formed by what is other than us, brought into being by what is other than us. This is obviously the case with, you know, children, adults, education, so forth. So the mimetic nature of desire is merely to point out something which in a sense is common sense, that all our desire doesn't originate in us. It's all borrowed, if you like to use that term. It's all something which we pick up from other people. We learn what we want from other people. And that makes us slightly different from our nearest simian relatives, our nearest ape relatives, who are just less effective imitators than we are. And that's, that's one of the things which, the great breakthroughs into harmonization was when we became such an extraordinarily competent imitating machine, which enables us to pick up a huge amount of cultural and social information and carry it around with us and communicate it very, very rapidly.
It's interesting because there is a certain sense, I guess, that desire is something natural and innate, but it seems that mimetic desire is, or desire, according to Girard's perspective, is something which is sort of infinitely plastic and malleable.
Yeah, I don't know about infinitely, but yeah, I think it's worth making a distinction between instinct, which of course is biological. We get it, being the sort of ape we are. And any ape would have it, and any mammal has instinct, and lots of animals have instinct. The key moment happened when our instincts ceased to be the only thing that runs us, if you like, and that's what makes something desire as opposed to instinct. It doesn't mean that it's instead of instinct, it means it's, in a sense, it's more than instinct. It means that even our instincts reach us, are received by us in socialized forms, in culturally socialized forms, so that we don't only have an instinct for sleep, for food, for sex, etc., etc., but all of those things are received by us in culturally, culturally modified packages, let's say. So that's something which is specific to us being human.
And if we look at a modern example of this, it would seem that, you know, advertising and the market economy is somewhere where mimetic desire just sort of runs rampant and is created just over and over again.
Well, yes, I think that's one of the things that's interesting about this is that you can pick it up both in obvious things like advertising, where the key insight, which is that we desire according to the desire of another, appears to be well understood by advertisers who very reasonably, from their point of view, attempt to show us desirable people desiring something so that we find ourselves hooked into wanting things which actually we didn't really want in particular, but now we are convinced are absolutely central to us being people at all. If we don't have one, then we're somehow failing altogether. Think of, you can think of any number of gadgets or whatever that are absolutely must have in order to exist. And of course, this is true not only of advertising, but this is true of any of our adolescent experience as children in school courtyards and so on and so forth. How basic love affairs work, and this is not something you need any kind of doctorate to understand.
Mm. But what interests me about Girard is that he takes it as read that mimetic desire is hardwired into the human psyche. But reading what he has to say about it, it puts me in mind of Buddhism, which offers a means of freeing us from uncontrolled desire and from the rivalries and competing desires that cause violence. And I wonder if you see mimetic desire as inescapable, or if you believe it's possible to learn a non-mimetic form of desire. I mean, I think you've already answered that earlier on, but can we just go to that?
Yeah. Yes, I mean, terms like hardwired and so on are difficult with this. I think that how we cope with our imitative desire, the fact that all our desire is imitative, is reactive in that sense, is a problem that all serious religious traditions, of which Buddhism is manifestly one, take very seriously. How to get out of reactive cycles of retribution, vengeance, rivalry, and so on. And given how easily we find ourselves carried into those, scarcely being aware of what's drawing us until we find ourselves locked into different forms of rivalry, naturally, any attempt to teach us to how to not have our buttons pushed, if you like, to use ordinary language, is very important. Now, I don't think that that means that we cease desiring, because if we cease desire, we would just cease to be human. And I think that that's if you like, if there is a difference there, it's between if there's a difference. And obviously, this is something that would require people who know much more about the finer details of Buddhism than I do. If there is a difference, it's the notion that getting rid of desire is actually simply ceasing to be human. Desiring, being part of a flow of desire, is actually what keeps us being human. And so the whole question is, how do we find ourselves, how would we say this, inflecting our desire so that it enters into non-rivalistic self-giving patterns rather than rivalistic and self, self-building up and self-glorifying patterns. Mm. And I think that would be absolutely in common with exactly the forms of Buddhism you describe.
Well, of course, Girard sees the old-time religion answer to controlling desire and the kinds of violence that desire generates in scapegoating. This is a characteristic of archaic cultures. It seems to have survived the shift to modernity, though, remarkably well. Can you tell me, first of all, about scapegoating? How does that mechanism work? How does scapegoating control desire-driven violence? And do you think we do still see it today in the civilized modern West?
Oh, of course we do. I mean, Girard's point, is we use the word scapegoating very loosely here because, of course, the word scapegoating implies a form of knowledge that ancient societies, archaic societies, didn't have, which is that if we call someone a scapegoat, we mean by that that they're someone being held responsible for something that they didn't in fact do. That's what, when someone says I'm a scapegoat, or when we point to someone and say they were scapegoated, what we mean is they are innocent though held guilty. They're a patsy. They're someone else's fall guy. Now, in the archaic culture, what you're talking about is the what Girard refers to as the random victimage mechanism, by which all against all becomes all against one. And this is a mechanism. This is something which just appears to happen. No one appears to run it. It's not a cognitive thing. How do groups, when in the midst of a frenzy owing to rivalry in which they could very easily destroy themselves, how is it that in some societies, the ones which survive, they manage to gather together around someone held to be the bad guy, and they all believe that that person is the bad one or the bad group. And that believing it is vital for the thing to work. In other words, there's a certain level of self-deception built in to that gathering together around someone held to be guilty. And it's that, how would you say it? It's that deception, that self-deception that Girard sees as having been exploded in the modern world, largely by the gospel texts, the Judeo-Christian thing, if you like, because it's as we become aware of what we're doing and cease to believe in the efficacy, if you like, we start actually to question whether such and such a person really did do it, whether they really are guilty, that we start to become aware of what we're doing and start to stand back from it. Now, as you point out, this doesn't mean to say that the mechanism stops. How could it? It's actually, to say hardwired is wrong, but it's become coterminous with our cultural, our ability to keep things going. And this is a point which Girard makes. Girard is not, you know, having shown the rather terrible thing which the victim mechanism is, he doesn't say and this is simply a bad thing which must stop. He points out that it's only because of that, it's because we've been able to create unity over against a wicked other and therefore develop myths, prohibitions, rituals, that we have been able to create a certain, that groups were able to create a certain togetherness and cohesiveness over time. Without that, groups wipe themselves out. And of course, there's no shortage of groups, tribes, that have wiped themselves out over time. We humans are dangerous to each other. There seems to be no question about that. Now, in the modern world, of course, what we are faced with is a very complex reality of huge numbers of people engaging in the mechanism while being half aware of what they're doing and beginning to learn what they're doing, with the result that it's not done innocently. People are aware that they're doing something terrible when they scapegoat someone, or other people point it out to them very quickly when they're doing it. And if you like, the innocence, the false innocence, starts to break down. And then you get all sorts of particularly modern pathologies, like people using the sense of being a victim in ideological ways as ways of getting brownie points over against other people. Oh, I'm the victim, you're against me, therefore I'm special and good and holy. If you like, we get that sort of knowing, the victimology, which has come to characterize so much of, as you say, modern Western, not only modern Western, because it's universal, modern discourse. If one can present oneself as a victim, then one's automatically good, which is exactly an inversion of the whole victimary thing, which Girard points out.
Where do you see it happening? Can you give me an example of this mechanism at work? Maybe not the victim mechanism to begin with, but the scapegoating mechanism, albeit in bad faith. Where do you see it happening?
In bad faith? Let me just give the example which Girard himself gives at the beginning of one of his books, The Scapegoat. I think it's a very good example. He quotes a medieval French poet called Guillaume de Machaut, who describes a terrible disaster befalling the people and some sort of plague, pestilence for befalling people, and the people casting round and begging God to let them know who caused this, and God revealing to them that it was the wicked Jews who poisoned the wells and caused this plague. And so, luckily, because they've had this pointed out to them, the people rise up and kill lots of Jews and massacre lots of people, and then mysteriously the whole thing goes away. And peace breaks out, and God is happy in his heaven, and peace has broken out on earth, etc., etc. And Girard reads that and says, listen, anybody who reads that nowadays understands that this is a tale of persecution. Once we read that, we know automatically that the people who did it were describing a real event, a genuine plague, and ascribing to it false causes. In other words, the wickedness of a particular group of people, in this case, Jews. And that any of us reading that passage know two things simultaneously. One, that they're saying something true, there was a plague, and two, something false, that it was caused by these people. We know that without thinking about it. And I think that the same is often true of many modern equivalents. Such and such a thing is blamed on a particular group of people. And it can be this or that immigrant group of people. We've had a huge amount of discussion here in the United States just over the last few days about this, as a group of people who saw themselves as victims of a new order are shocked to discover how their victimology doesn't work any longer. Hence in the wake of the Romney defeat, we get this the whole time. I'm sure that you have similar things in Australia.
Well, it puts me in mind of same-sex marriage, which is sort of constantly bubbling away as an issue in the mainstream churches, and it makes me think of a situation where you have marriage in decline and the search for something which can be explained as a cause of that or as a threat to this fragile institution, and we seize on same-sex marriage. Is that a similar kind of mechanism there?
Yes, I think so. I think that panic about just more or less any cultural change can fixate on some people who are held to be responsible for it, even though it must be manifest to anybody that the principal enemies of the sanctity of heterosexual marriage are heterosexuals. I mean, That's right. There's no evidence at all to suggest that gay people cause straight marriages to break up simply by virtue of wanting to get married. I think you're right. I think that's a very good. I think it's a very good parallel. But this is nothing to do particularly with gay and straight people. There have been panics about marriage for the last several hundred years. So this is merely another rerun of a very traditional melody that we're hearing. The chances are that, in fact, the changes in women's status and the possibility of women being able to own property and not being the property of their husbands was a far, far greater change in marriage than the admission of same-sex couples to the same institution. And that, of course, caused huge upset at the time. It's the collapse of the natural order of the universe, et cetera, which put men above women and so on and so forth. I think that in any moment of where people feel that there is a threat of social loss of difference, loss of structure, there is a flailing about to try and find someone or some group who can be held responsible for this as a way of trying to hold the whole thing together. And these panics, they appear to work for a short time, but after a bit it becomes clear that a real change has happened and the reasons for the panic start to flow away, which I think is what's happening throughout the Western world, at least with relation to same-sex marriage. People are simply becoming aware that it does not cause problems. I mean, it's comparatively banal and indifferent as regards its effect on everybody else. Nothing happens.
Well, if we can take this back to religion, Girard talks about the persecution of the innocent victim as something characteristic of archaic religions, sacrificing the innocent, the victim god. But of course we see this at work in Christianity and in the gospel stories, and yet the Bible and the gospel stories are held to be different in some way. What's the difference there?
Well, can I just very slightly correct what you said before?
Sure.
He says about being something characteristic of archaic religions. And I think what he says, what he sees it as being something which is characteristic of archaic societies. I think that there's quite an important point there, because he's not talking about something that is primarily religious and secondary social. He's saying that, if you like, it's this mechanism that has enabled there to be the cultural matrix which we call society. In other words, that the question, what we now call religions, are different ways of dealing with the same underlying social reality. And the same underlying social reality is one in which humans tend to survive victimarily. And this is something which has started in archaic societies, because that's who we are. And we now deal with in different ways by what we call religion. But in the sense, all religions are run by the same mechanism of violence. The question is it possible for us as human to be becoming self-critical with relation to this? And that's where, as you know, Girard introduces the element of the gospel critique as being a voice from elsewhere. Someone actually saying to humans, this is what you do, you needn't be run by this any longer. But this is, if you like, it's an undoing of religion. That's the bizarre point of Girard's claim. Is he's saying religions, all of them, including, of course, Christianity and the ways which we live it out, is run by the same mechanism. The only really interesting question is it possible for there to be a self-critical voice in the midst of this? And the way that Girard presents the gospel and understands the gospel, which is the way that I understand it, he's saying, yes, there is a self-critical voice which is available to us humans, and the shape of it is the overcoming of the victim mechanism, and that's what the gospel text and the extraordinary insights of the Hebrew scriptures bear witness to, the overcoming of the human overcoming of the human victory mechanism.
And how does this amount to an undoing of religion? That's a really interesting phrase you use.
Well, if what we have as human beings are cultures which are formed in this way, you know, groups which hold together by in and out, good and bad, us and not us, in other words, whose identity is over against some other, then, and this appears to be the case, we don't know of any group anywhere in the world that doesn't do this in some way or other, that doesn't depend on that kind of distinction. In fact, we wouldn't really know what language was like if that kind of distinction wasn't available to people. If that's true about humans, then the moment you remove the over-against, then you're undoing or threatening to undo all forms of cultural stability, all distinctions between in and out, all distinctions between us and not us. And that is a very seriously culturally destabilizing thing to do. I mean, that's actually undoing, it's really tampering with the software that runs the human the human experience, if you see what I mean. So, I think that it's if it's true that human societies function victimarily and someone comes along and takes the plug out of the bath, then of course it's actually affecting the whole of the way humans run society. And that means it's what appears to be a religion, but it's in fact undoing religiousness.
And it's doing this by introducing the perspective of the victim. Is that what's different and what Christianity brings in that's new, or the biblical narrative? We're looking at the mechanism of victim persecution from the victim's perspective.
From the victim's perspective, that's right, yes. I think that's the central insight, that the realization that that the victim is hated without cause, to use... That's the phrase which appears, the quote from the psalm, which appears, I think, in John's Gospel. They hated me without cause. The notion, and I think this is something that, think about this, how destabilizing it is. If what we're used to, more or less, in our societies is religious authority on the one hand and civil authority on the other, which can often, very often be blurred. They can very often come together in various different ways in different cultural groups. But we're used to something iconic within that, which is that the central scene of the gospel has the religious authority, and which should be backed up by God, and the political authority, which should be backed up by Caesar. And they are both handing over to his death someone accused of various forms of sedition, political sedition and religious sedition. Blasphemy or sedition. The two come together nicely in this person. And in this icon, we are told God is not in the backing up to the political system. God is not in the backing up to the religious system. God is on the cross. God is the victim of those two, of the conspiracy, of the breathing together of those two. That's where God is to be found. This is a very seriously destabilizing icon as regards any attempt to create religious and political social order. And it's a very seriously destabilizing thing, whatever the formal name of your religion is.
Why do you think that this destabilization has been so successful and so powerful? I mean, it's interesting to consider that when people talk about the success, the historical success and influence of Christianity, they usually tie it in with Christianity becoming the religion of empire and sort of becoming sedimented in our political structures for hundreds and hundreds of years. But what you're pointing to in the gospel narrative there is something completely apart from all that, which has these sort of apocalyptic implications. Why do you think that's the case? Why is it so powerful?
It suggests something. It suggests that there's a genie which has got out of the bottle, toothpaste has got out of the tube and can't be put back in together again. Something to do with a certain understanding of freedom from underneath that can never be, what's the word, locked down again. And I think that is something rather remarkable. I mean, you know, I think that's one of the reasons why, little by little, with enormous difficulty, we've learned certain things, for instance, about slavery, about it being wrong. This is enormously, just think the importance of slavery as a human cultural construct, how important that has been for the social and political, I put it in quotes, well-being of powerful nations throughout history, and the gradual realization that humans are equal and cannot be property one of another is a hugely subversive but also hugely enriching phenomenon. And once it's happened, it's recognized as simply something that's true. You can't go back on it in good conscience. And the same is true with the discovery of the equality of women. Once it's recognized, it can't be gone back on in good conscience. I personally think the same thing is happening with the gay and lesbian issue at the moment. The moment you start recognizing that this is a non-pathological minority variant in the human condition rather than some form of defect, then this is something that cannot be gone back on in good conscience. So little by little, these rather subversive things from underneath are coming to be seen to be a perfectly normal structuring part of society. And each one of them, as each one has happened, it has seemed that it's causing a crack in the whole system. The whole system is about to blow apart. And in each case, it's this something from underneath that has opened up a new way of being human and without the threatened collapse. That's what I think you're right. I think that there is something apocalyptic about that. It means that we're always living in a slightly frightening space because we're always alarmed that this may run away with us. And that's, very often what happens. I think it's really interesting in that sense to read not Christian comments about Christianity, but some of the more fundamentalist Islamic scholars. And I think of some of the followers of Qutb, one of the founders of the Egyptian Brotherhood, who understood quite clearly that it was the failure of the West, if you like, to hold together the religious and the political. It was like the freedom of desire. That was the dangerous thing. That was what was wrong. You need to hold the two together in order to stop this constant breakdown and erosion of society. I think that's a very insightful critique. I'm glad to be on the other side of it, if you like. I think that they've perceived something that we often don't perceive about ourselves, which is that Christianity, by not accepting the togetherness of God and Caesar, but by indicating the presence of God in the victim, is constantly opening up the possibility of desire, which is a very dangerous thing to do. And our learning how to surf those waves is not an easy thing to do. And we constantly get it wrong.
Mm. It's interesting because it puts me in mind of a lot of the discourse around atheism today, where secular society is seen as being the answer to violence and a way out of the irrationalisms that are supposedly brought in by religions of various kinds. And yet what Girard would say, what Said Qutb would say, is that secularism in some sense inaugurates a spinning out of control of those things, certainly of violence.
Yeah, I mean, the notion that secularism is automatically self-critical of its own violence seems to me to be even more laughable than the claim that religion is self-critical of its own violence. So let's think of the... you don't need to look very far at the great figures of the 20th century to see who wins the prize as regards more violence. The answer is Mao, Stalin, and Hitler beat everybody hands down. Basically, there really is no competition on that one. No, I mean, if what we're saying is true, then it's humans who are violent. It's not a question of whether your ideology is violent or not. Your ideology is a reflection of humans. The question of how to be self-critical as humans is the critical question, which is why I think that, easy resorts to, secularism is either a good thing as opposed to bad religion or is a bad thing as opposed to good religion, miss the point completely. How are we to be self-critical in our institutional living? I don't think that there is an answer to that that doesn't include an understanding of how the innocence of victims becomes revealed.
I'd like to turn to something now which touches on something you mentioned a few moments ago. You talked about victim culture. And you've written about worship, and you've said that in true worship there's no attempt to build up the unanimity of those who feel themselves victimized. There's no propagation of a comforting myth. And the repetition, the rehearsal of the memory of being victimized is always mythical, always a lie. Can you unpack that for me? What do you mean by true and false worship here?
Yeah, I mean, I try as you know in the article to which you're referring, I give as an example the Nuremberg Rally as being a good example of worship in the ordinary human sense. In other words, mass gatherings of people to celebrate something together. And what a both a very attractive and a very dangerous thing it is. And there are no lack of cultural equivalents of Nuremberg rallies in all our cultures and societies. And of course, we all feel their intoxication, and we are all slightly aware of how dangerous they can be. That's what I mean by the dangerousness, if you like, of worship. And the oddness of Christian worship is that it requests us to stand around a victim, recognizing our complicity in that victim's torture and execution, and allow ourselves to be forgiven, which means called into being without rivalry by somebody who loves us despite everything that we've done and loves us as we are. Now, that's a very odd form of worship. There's nothing, there's not an obvious intoxicating togetherness to come from that, which is why I think that, you know, most of us take an awfully long time take a long time to find ourselves, learn how to pray, for instance, at the Eucharist or the Mass. It's not simply a question of, you know, I want to say creating togetherness. It's learning how to undergo the opening up of the presence of the forgiving victim in our midst over time, which in itself teaches us how to become together, how to come together in non-rivalistic and non-victimizing ways. But that's a very slow, delicate business, and certainly one which I haven't got right.
You've referred to it as a somewhat boring process too. It's sort of the opposite of the intoxication and the excitement of that other kind of worship you're talking about.
Yes, I think that's right. I think that's because it assumes that at its center there is the presence of the one who forgives us, and that while we're high on feeling, we can't actually pick him up. While we're high on the various forms of, you know, the various forms of excitement and passion which forms of coming together can produce in us, it's like, you know, we're not sufficiently detoxed to be able to perceive the one who is there forgiving us and reaching out to us. So, yes, I think that it is underwhelming. That's been made even more underwhelming by the awfulness of the translation into English of the new rite of the Mass. But anyhow, that's a little separate apart.
Sure.
Excuse me.
We do have, though, don't we? We do have a very strong cultural orientation towards memorials and ceremonies of remembrance, particularly groups of people who've been the victims of violence in the past. And I mean, it's interesting. Yeah. You talk about the Nuremberg rally as being a form of false worship. What about something like a Holocaust memorial? I mean, it's a very sort of emotional example to throw up there, but is there something about that that also looks to what you would call false worship?
Yes, yeah. Any one of these things, if they're a way of a group asserting innocence over others, has become a form of idolatry. That's true of whether it's Holocaust museums or cenotaphs or whatever. The really, really difficult thing to remember is any of those memorials as a, this is where we screwed up. We need to remember that we screwed up. In as far as the Holocaust memorial teaches us to remember how we screwed up, not how they screwed up, but how we screwed up, then it can be part of a proper remembering. But if it's an identity boost over against others, well, then it's a recipe for repetition of the same thing. And, you know, I think that's something which is all, which we all have to be sensitive on. You know, in Australia, as in England, when Armistice Day comes around and you have different days when you celebrate your many military fallen, in the case of Australia, who fell very, you know, very poignantly in other people's wars. It's something very, very moving to remember, why did these people die? What were we involved in that enabled us so happily to sacrifice people for the, you know, what the poet referred to as the old lie, dulce et decorum est pro patria morai. that's but the poet had it right. It is a lie. Mm. Dulce et decor. It is a sweet and decorous thing to die for your country. No, it isn't. It's an awful thing.
And so things like Anzac memorials should be drawing us to reflect on our complicity in what happened,
yes,
not our innocence.
Because only with complicity only with some understanding of complicity do we have a chance of working out what we got wrong the previous time and how to avoid it again, how not to be sucked into doing the same thing. I think that complicity becomes, in the scheme that we're talking about, the Girardian scheme, complicity becomes a hugely significant, if you like, part of the building block, right? Ethical sentiment, let's say.
But do we really see Holocaust memorialization in this as well? I don't want to sort of harp on about it, but I just want to sort of get past the point where we appear to be saying that there was a complicity on the part of the Jews in the violence that was directed against them. Remembered.
Mm. I think that the key thing for Holocaust memorials is that they'd be put up in places by the people who were slow to respond to the needs of others. I mean, which is what typically happens. Even in the countries that were the victors in the Second World War, there's a good deal of evidence to show that they knew what was going on and they didn't take the appropriate steps in time and so on and so forth. You know, we're all slow for such things like that. It's terribly important that we remember that this happened. No, this is not a criticism of Jewish people, though. Naturally enough, Jewish people have to be very careful, as you know, the use of sacred status to give a moral free hand with dealing with other people like Palestinians in their own homeland, etc., is very complicated. The mutual use of the victim card means endless conflict. And that's something which, alas, we see far too frequently.
Mm. Well, a major curb on religious violence has been the advent of religious pluralism and the insistence that all religions lead to the same truth in spite of their surface differences. But Girard situates the Judeo-Christian narrative, the biblical narrative, at the centre of human history, and he's been accused of a certain Christian imperialism as a result. But given the primacy that Girard gives to the Bible, how is it possible to fit his work into a religiously pluralistic framework?
Hmm. Well, again, I think that the issue is misunderstood if you treat it as though what Girard is talking about is religious treatment of religion. He's talking about human treatment of human. When you say that pluralism has acted as a bulwark, I just wonder whether this is true. I wonder whether we know of any society in which there is peaceful coexistence with a pluralistic religious framework that is not forcibly held in place by a more powerful body which imposes its view of what the rule of law is. In other words, where there isn't, in fact, a certain sense of someone, maybe it's what we would call a lay state, having a monopoly of violence in the area of religion, therefore obliging other people to live according to certain more restricted definitions of themselves. I wonder whether there is such a thing, therefore, as religious pluralism. I'm honestly not sure that there is. I suspect that there is different forms of power being used differently, which is why I think I want to bring back the Girard's point. This is not a question of comparative religion. It's not a question of comparative understandings of sacrifice. It's a question of, is it possible for humans to be self-critical? Now, how different religions are able to answer that question seems to me to be something that's well worth sharing. But the fundamental question is a question about being human, not about being religious.
Well, over all of this lies an apocalyptic shadow where, as you say, the genie's out of the bottle, the toothpaste can't be put back in the tube, and the breakdown of the efficacy of scapegoating means that we no longer have a way of regulating our violent desires. Girard sees a rather terrifying end to all of this, an apocalyptic end. You say that you have a sense of something quietly emerging while this is going on. What is that something, and do you see it as a counter to the trajectory of violent escalation that we see at work in the world?
I don't know whether counter is exactly the right word, but I think we're talking about simultaneous, something simultaneous. I mean, I try to flesh out, that's my attempt to flesh out what is meant by Jesus telling his disciples, my peace I give you, my peace I leave you, not the peace of this world. In other words, the sense that simultaneously and in the midst of all this violence and all this increasingly chaotic patterns in which no one can quite work out where they are, which seems to me to be where many of us are most of the time, at least I certainly am, that there is the possibility of the beginnings of a peaceful living together, which we usually only get in little signs here and there, and that this happens not as a counter to, in the sense of, I don't know, some dramatic counter force that is on the same level as the violence, but appears to be able to be dwelt in by us in the midst of all the violence. And I think that that's what I would hope is meant by the beginnings of church, the beginnings of the ecclesial sign. I mean, that's to use Catholic jargon, if you'll excuse it. But it's, I don't see it as being a counter force in the sense in which it's a different ideology at work, but it's the possibility of living in a self-giving away type of way, which means that it's possible to become comparatively immune to be being run from the violence. Not easily, with a great deal of difficulty, but it's possible. Mm. And it's possible to do this socially, together.
Does it mean that Christians working for peace and justice in the world should be thinking small in some sense and concentrating on the day-to-day, on the local, because at the global level things are falling apart, the centre cannot hold?
I think it means that humans working together for peace and justice always have to think small at the same time as they think big, because the notion that we could get something right socially and not get it right personally, or get something right personally and not get it right socially, is part of the problem. There isn't that difference between what's private and local and what's public and widespread, as it were. I think that that's something which we really have to get used to. Charity really does both start at home and affect everything. We're run by the same forces socially, institutionally, as we are personally, privately, in our families, in our relationships. These are the same patterns of desire that run us. So think small, think local is also think big.